Yo, hello, and welcome to In the Lane, a Miami Heat and NBA podcast hosted by the great people at Anchor and powered by Five Reasons Sports Network. I have a lot of great guests. I've had a lot of great guests, okay? I've had few with maybe the vernacular and ability to communicate basketball as well as Mike Prada. I have Mike Prada with me here today. Thank you for spending time with me, man. Thank you for coming in.
Hey, you're welcome. And that intro was total shit. You should do it again.
I probably will do it again. I probably will stop it, edit it, and do it again.
That's an inside joke from our pre-convo, for those who don't know. But no, that's way too kind what you said. I'm sorry it took you so long to get on here. You reached out to me so long ago, and I was really bad at responding. It's not like I have a lot going on now, so I feel bad about that, but I'm glad I'm here right now.
It's okay, Mike. It's only 5% interest every day you didn't reply.
Okay, fair enough. So that's a lot of interest shit.
Yeah, it's a lot, brother. It's a lot.
Times 90?
I'm gonna need it direct deposited tonight.
I'll see what I can do.
So you have found your way to this very interesting place, right? In journalism. Even as you sit right now, you're in a very unique, interesting place. But before we get to those places, right, in order to talk to me the way that me and you communicated on Twitter, right, about the minutiae, the details of basketball and what makes a play happen and how players are engaged in actions, you have to really give a shit about basketball. You have to be very passionate for it. Where did you start to develop that passion? Where did you find that place?
My wife's like, man, do you really have to watch all these games? And I'm like, I mean, do I? Like, it's like a daily conversation. Where did it all start? It's a good question. I think, you know, this is a show where people open up and get vulnerable. And so I had when I was 16, my dad died in a car, or 15, my dad died in a car, single car accident. And basketball was one of the things that we shared, the two of us growing up. He would take me to, then it was called US Air Arena, you know, just me and him. My mom, we had a great family, but this was like our thing. He was a big Celtics fan. He renounced that fandom because we lived in DC, and we would go together, the two of us, and we would go to watch, you know, Don McLean and Rex Chapman and Juwan Howard, Chris Webber, George Mirason. George Mirason is my favorite player. We would go to those games. I was at game three in 1997 when they played the Bulls. And that was kind of our thing. And I maybe like by around the time when he passed, I was sort of going more towards the college game. And I think at that point, like maybe, I don't know if I necessarily thought about this consciously until a few years later. And I've written about our relationship on Bulls Forever back in the day. I don't remember where that post is, but it felt a little bit like that coming back to this was like a way of like kind of remembering him and carrying out something that we shared without necessarily me realizing it. And so I think that maybe is where sort of the drive and the love comes from. You know, I had all the cards growing up. I had like bins and bins. I'd watch as much as I could. I loved the game in the 90s. You know, you see how much I post NBA and NBC shit. But I think at a certain point, maybe a few years after he passed, it's sort of him when he did it. And so I started Bulls Forever sometime in college. I just figured I had gotten into the blog world, just reading a lot of those blogs from people like Tom Ziller, who I worked with for a decade. It was incredible. Matt Bernhardt, Henry Abbott, like kind of at the very pre-Darko. And I just sort of, at the time, SB Nation was just a tiny little blog network. And I think I started a blog spot where I would just watch the Wizards all the time. And at some point I just reached out. I was like, hey, you guys need a Wizards blog. Like, what do you think? And it took a little while and I sort of signed on there and I got a league pass. I watched the games in college and it kind of just snowballed from there. I think I caught it at a really good time when it was like right at the beginning of this independent publishing era. In 2009, after I graduated college, the Wizards allowed me and Kyle Weedow, who runs Truth About It. I don't know if that site's still active. They gave us credentials. You know, I did journalism in college. You know, I was editor of the school paper. I think I got into it that way. And that just how I started, I sort of was like already, it was a weird thing because I'm like this 22-23-year-old kid in out of college covering a team without, like, that wasn't my full-time job at the time. I was just covering the team. I was like driving down to training camp, and I didn't know what the hell I was doing. Like, I don't understand. I still, to this day, like, I don't understand why some of the writers, including, like, you know, Michael Lee was super great to me. Like, why would they were accepting me just like walking to their place, like a kid out of college, think I could do what they did. And I couldn't, still can't. But that's kind of how, and it just kind of snowballed from there. I kind of was very lucky to be involved with SB Nation at the very beginning. I kind of had got in there, and, you know, we tried a lot of stuff at SB Nation. We went through 700 different iterations trying to adjust to the web. It was kind of a great place to really develop certain skills of yours and, you know, be free to fail and learn. So I guess that's kind of where, how I all got in. But I think if you're asking me, like, why do I care so much? It probably goes back to that. What happened, it probably goes back to sort of, I've always loved basketball, but in some way, like, sort of, it was a way to sort of stay connected to some memory of my dad, maybe.
Another common thread we share is NBC Universal Comcast. And I was doing box sales out of that store for like 5 years. And that was just what I was doing. I was just a salesman, making pretty good money for like a kid my age. Like, I was definitely making more money than everybody. What you start realizing, though, is that's a trap. That's a trap. You make pretty good money for a kid your age, and you just make that same money your whole life and you never go anywhere.
Yeah. Or you end up like me and you lose your job and you make no money.
Well, you know, there's some slack, right?
Yeah, I shouldn't be that. That was a little too glib. Things will, you know, but it's just, look, life is weird. It takes you through a lot of comfort versus ambition is such an interesting. I mean, to take this back to basketball, like, that is basketball and the NBA in a lot of ways. In a lot of these, I think one of the reasons that, like, I think about basketball the way I do is that it is a very nakedly human sport in that you are not like, you are working collaboratively with some people. It is on a court. It is continuous. It keeps going. And ultimately it is about sort of the relationship between different forces that you cannot possibly know everything that goes into why a shot goes in or why a shot doesn't go in or why a team performs well. You can identify all the forces, but there are just so many of them that there is no one thing. You know, it's not a sport where there's like a one-to-one relationship between action and outcome. That's sort of how life is.
Yeah.
You know, you learn. And I think that's what I think is why I think basketball is such an interesting sport. You know, the number of people is constrained. Everybody's sort of responsible for each other, but there is this sort of ambition versus comfort dynamic that is like underpinning all of these teams and all these players. You know, there is a certain place where it crosses and you have what you need, but it's very hard to figure out exactly what that place is. You know, you see so many, I mean, I'm trying to think of like a good Miami example, but like Kyle Lowry is such an interesting, like, kind of comfort versus ambition cross point. You know, he seems like he's hit a comfortable stage in what he is. And like, so far, at least, like, that's kind of what Miami needs. And you contrast that with someone like Tyler Hero, who's perhaps more in an ambition stage of his career. Like, where do you get to where as a team, you've got comfort and ambition crossing? That to me is like the magic of basketball. And it's, I don't know, not to get too crazy about it, but like, that's how life is too. You know, there's certain points where you want more and there's certain points where you don't want to take that step. You know, and where at a certain point, those two forces have to cross together to make where you are in life.
Yeah, I think that in the way that I rationalize reality is usually through sport and usually through basketball. But I find that like basketball's poetry and how it mirrors society and life and what we deal with day in day. And I think like when it's not given that respect, it's kind of easy to belittle or put off to the side, but basketball is really important in our culture. Like, just at a base level, it's really important in culture and society. You said something earlier about through, you know, finding that cross, but also what's required to build that ambition, what's required to build that comfort is to move away from negative experiences too. So it's like Giannis, for instance. Have you read Mirren's book on Giannis?
I have read Mirren's book, yeah. I Man, I worked with when Mirren was, I was so lucky to be able to edit her like number of years ago before she got big. And
yeah,
she was always super thorough. I read that book. It's a great illustration of like kind of the challenges of comfort versus ambition.
For sure. Exactly.
You know, because I think I know where you're going with this, but you tell me if I'm wrong. You know, he starts off where he has nothing. So like first the objective is to survive. And then as he kind of continues to advance, there are all these points where he could like sort of accept a certain place. You know, he's made it at all these times, right? Like if he played for that Greek club team and was good for his whole career and played for, whether he signed for Real Zaragoza, it was some Spanish team, he would have made it, but like only like kind of some crazy ambition and discomfort, like kind of put him into where he is today. You know, to a certain degree, like he's successful, he just gets out. And like, why is it that some players just can never seem comfortable and have that intrinsic motivation? It's just an interesting thing. And the NBA is like a sport where like all the guys that are in the sport that have reached this level have some fucking crazy level of that, like sort of, and that's why I also think it's such a insecure sport. It's a sport that's built on confidence. It's a sport where like all these guys are unhappy all the time. And that like sort of the thing that's coming out. It's just amazing.
They're starting to get to these places where they can develop some science for it. Even, you know, Ben Taylor, even Ben Taylor is kind of starting to look into certain things with other guys who that's just dissecting. What is basketball IQ? Like what is that stuff? What is quick twitch muscles? Like what does that mean to your brain chemistry? Yeah.
It's funny. I don't want to give too much of the book away because it's not coming out for a whole damn year. And I'm not I just finished a chapter on like kind of spatial awareness and passing. And it's my theory that passing is at an all time high right now. Like the average passer is better than at any point that they were 20 years ago. Like just if you think about it, like there are so many no look passes that happen over wide periods that we've so badly taken for granted. So why is that? And like ultimately a lot of it is that we've learned different things about how we map the court. So it's I spent a lot of time reading through like vision studies and academic journals, and there's something interesting going on. And it to your point, like it's a lot like kind of we're getting more into this stuff now. So yeah, I know exactly what you mean. Like what, like in a weird way, like kind of, I make this analogy in the chapter. I don't want to give too much away and we'll see if it makes a final addition. Like we call basketball IQ and feel for the game, right? Those are like two terms that we kind of use to mean the same thing. One is like a scientific thing and one is like a total intangible. So how the hell is it that we use the same phrase for the same two very different phrases to describe the same thing? Like that doesn't make any sense.
He has the fire in his eyes. You know what I mean?
Right. He has a certain intelligence that is literally a thing you measure. But then he has this like anthropomorphous feel for the game. And somehow these two things mean the same thing. I don't know. I just think that's weird. I don't know what to do with. I mean, I don't want to give away too much of what to do with that because that's kind of
through the book chapter. Yeah, you might be breaking down what to do with that.
Yeah, I mean, it's in the chapter, but like, isn't that like, it's so weird? Like, what do you do with that?
I don't know. And these are the questions I heard partially Ben asking about, just like basketball IQ, but they were more structuring it around like quick twitch muscles and that kind of stuff. But what is that? What does basketball IQ really relate to as far as like a justifiable action based off of a thought, right? Something that comes from a thought. And how do you measure those things? And that's difficult, man. And I think that as we start to progress faster into sports science, some of that stuff can be answered. And I don't know if we ever get to like, what makes a guy like Jimmy Butler work in the league? You know what I mean? Somebody who just really probably by circumstance should not be at the place he is. And even his career through the league is so unorthodox. How does he find a way to progress and succeed? Even though like the guys that you consider to be those all-star ceiling dudes are first round draft picks, lottery picks, right? They have this certain path.
Well, it's funny, less so now, I feel like, than before. I mean, Nikola Jokic, our last two several MVPs, like Nikola Jokic was a second round pick.
Right.
Giannis was the 15th pick. I'm sure, like, if you still go by, like, kind of the most often it's the number one guys, but I mean, Tyler Hero was the 13th pick, and there is someone who burst on the scene. It seems like we are in an, I don't know if we're drafting better or worse, or if it's just we're developing better or what it is, but it does feel like there are more players who are drafted lower in the draft who turn out to be these superstars.
Kawhi Leonard. I feel like there's old basketball mindsets too that stick. Yes. Like I heard PJ Tucker today on JJ Redick's podcast, and he's talking about how he got kicked out of the league because nobody knew what to do with him. Like, he was a tweener. Nobody right. knew where to play him or what to do. And even that term tweener, like, that's gone now from the lexicon.
Right. So the main premise of this book that I'm almost done with that's coming out in a year, that like is the game changed way faster than we realized.
Mm-hmm.
And way quicker and way more dramatically. The analogy I use is often, I think you may have heard this, but it's as if you had the court that we played on, even though the court dimensions have not changed, the practical playing surface, i.e. where you can actually put the ball in the basket from,
mm-hmm.
has basically doubled. If you think about it from maybe, let's say this, it's doubled from 20 years ago. And it's probably 1.5 times as big as it was even 5 years ago.
Yeah, big three era ball looks completely different than this brand right. of basketball Miami plays now.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that's really striking when you watch some of those old games, is that you look at where these guys are standing, and that was a team, that was a team, and I know I posted clips about this before, but that was a team, the big three, that was considered a very open team. You know, they played pace and space. They're all standing on top of the three-point line, never further behind it. You know, they're never running screens like 40 feet from the basket like they do with Damian Lillard. You know, their shooters are it's not as spread. And players, the other thing that's really striking is that, like, kind of they're getting into their offense at 14 seconds.
Yeah.
Not at now, it's like if you're not into your offense at 20, 19 seconds, I mean, just I don't think we fully comprehended yet. And this is what I hope, why I hope the book works, how drastic a change that is. And PJ Tucker is a great example in a league where you're playing only in this little surface for most of the time. His lack of height and whatever, his inability to jump, because, you know, you're fitting 5-10 players into this space. So it's more the space above you matters and the power. That's a liability. But then you spread the court out. And now you make it so that how do you guard in space? How do you play in space? You know, that becomes more important. Suddenly his, like, sort of big fat, like, kind of hips and chest and all that shit that he has, that's really valuable. It stops you in space. And, you know, that right there is a great illustration of just how fundamentally the same quality that he has changed in value. And I think we know this, but we haven't fully comprehended what this means. We step back a little bit, like what the game looked like. I mean, the Warriors in 2000, the biggest illustration of this, I think, is that, do you remember when there was that whole thing at Sloan where there was the Warriors felt like the Rockets were gamifying the game too much?
Yes.
And they step back threes, yes. and all that. And Bob Myers comes up at Sloan and he says, you know, sometimes you just need a two-pointer, you know, you just got to get the lead to 10. Like, do you really want to take a step back three? And I'm sitting there thinking, like, you guys fucking invented this style of play. And now you're like, so traditionalist. Like, how do you change that much in 3 years? To me, that's an amazing reflection of how much changed from the beginning of the Warriors run to now, is that the people who they were, like, number one in the league in mid-range shots 3 years after they had the light years run. It just goes to show, like, how much the innovators have become the establishment, like, so quickly in this league. And I don't think we have a really good sense of what the goal of the book ultimately is, like, what does that actually mean for all these elements of basketball? You know, what does it mean for superstars? What is a superstar now? What does it mean for positions? Is positionalist really what this is about? What does it mean for, like, three-point shooting? Like, how do you become a good shooter in this scenario? Like, you know, if you're tasked with taking 10 threes a game, and for your entire life you've been trained to take, like, 2 threes a game max, how do you change your motion so that you can actually get 10 threes a game off? I mean,
right,
what does it mean for defense? And, you know, it's interesting what we're seeing with the fouling now, that going down. Like, I just think we haven't processed quite yet how drastic a change this is, even relative to most of NBA history. These last 5 years, I think the gameplay has changed more here than like since the shot clock came into being. Like, that's the last time I think the game has changed so dramatically.
Well, even this year, me and you are just watching the Suns and being like, holy shit, they're running offense. Like, they're running almost like a half court set offense on the break. Like, they're finding a way to do a transition offensive set. What is, like, this is so wild to watch happen.
Yeah.
And this is at a place where if you sat me down, this is why the minds of basketball are so freaking smart. If you sat me down and asked how to, you know, innovate on the game as it is right now, I don't know if I could do it. Where are you on that? Like, do you see more innovation coming inside of the spacing? Do you see a return to like just size? Like, where do you feel the game might be going in its next innovation?
It's a good question and one I need to think about before I write this conclusion. Yeah. For sure. I do think what you're seeing this year and what you sort of, I trace a little bit of this back to when the Lakers won the bubble title and they sort of did it with like this gigantic size in LeBron. I do think that we are starting to see, and also what Milwaukee did with like the dunker spot on the baseline and all that. I do think you're starting to see a renewal of, we're moving a little bit further away from five out all the time and finding ways to kind of make it so that there's a threat on inside near the basket. And I think that will change. I don't know if that's going to get offense down necessarily, but I think it'll change the look and feel spacing a little bit. I think one thing that has happened as well this year is the new rules about foul baiting have been universally considered like, this is why free throw shooting is down, because they're getting rid of these bullshit fouls. To me, that I think is almost like they definitely play a role, but I think that's a tribute. You're attributing too much to them to say that is the only reason why it feels like there's more physical play this year. To me, the bigger thing that's been happening, and it's happening a little slowly, and I think the last couple of years you haven't really noticed it because without fans and stands, like, shooting is just so much easier. Like, shooting percentages are down this year, so it's like a more normal environment. I think that players are getting better at in playing one-on-one defense without using their hands. I think they have learned tactics to absorb more force in the chest, the success of guys like PJ Tucker, I think, is starting to become replicated around the league at all levels. You know, they have better core muscles. They almost look, the comparison I think about a lot is like a football defensive back. I think there are more of these great defenders look more like they would fit in, you know, covering who's the best receiver in football, DeAndre Hopkins. I don't really watch a lot of football. They almost look like, if you line them up against DeAndre Hopkins, that's kind of not that different from the challenge of guarding who's like a really quick player, like a Trae Young. It's not that different from guarding a DeAndre Hopkins. There's a lot of like sort of running with them in space and like kind of pivoting and flipping your hips. I think that more and more players are developing those tactics. And you see a guy like James Harden, who is definitely out of shape, and definitely is not getting some of those bullshit calls. Like, he had one against Bam the other day that they didn't call where he grabbed the arm. Did you see that? That one?
Yeah.
That must have made him very happy. So obviously they're not calling that. But there are just as many examples of the mechanism by which he drew so many of his fouls is he would get himself into you, and his chest and his hips were so strong, his trunk muscles, that he would just dislodge you and your body would have no choice but to bring your arms down. It's like physically hard for you to leave your arms up while you're trying to move with someone. Like, ever try doing it? Like, you can't do it. I'm just guessing. I certainly can't, you know, it's hard, but players are learning like sort of new techniques to open up their hip muscles and their core muscles. And now they're able to do it better. And so when he drives into you, you can absorb him in the chest and you'll keep your hands up and you won't lose your position the same way. And that, I think, is starting to take away some of his, and I think he's going to adjust because he's great in James Harden. I think you're seeing more and more of that. And so individual defense, I think, I don't see massive changes in the scheme happening yet. And I think that's like kind of another frontier. Like, at some point, like, we maybe need to rethink how we play defense just as a concept. Like, why, like, switching was the last big scheme sort of change. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't see one right now. I'd be curious what that is. But I think on an individual level, like, guys are just better at defense now, one-on-one. For years, we just, the hand-checking thing has never been called, and people just sort of were able to get away with bad habits. But now I think you look at a lot of these guys, some of the rookies coming out, like, who are more native in this sort of way of playing, like Davion Mitchell and Evan Mobley. And
yeah, Scotty, so Davion's Barnes, the guy that I thought of immediately when you're talking about this new defensive technique.
Yeah,
because he shows it. I mean, I don't, his game might take a while to catch up to some of these dudes like Scotty and Evan Mobley and Jalen Green, but Davion's the guy that I look at where I'm like, I don't know how long those dudes would be in the league, probably a really long time, but Davion will always have a spot on the team throughout, no matter what age he's at, because he's an right. excellent defender.
If you actually watch how he defends, what's kind of amazing is how much he's able to sort of mirror the movement of what the guy he's doing. He almost like kind of sees their counter move before their move.
Mm.
But I don't think that's a unique thing in NBA history. What I think is unique is that guys like Mitchell are able to do that and keep their hands down. That's a product of some of the new, when you play over this much space, you have to learn how to do that. Like, and I think for a while people were in denial about like, oh, we can't play defense because we can't use our hands, you know, but I think recently they've started to just adjust, and I'm seeing signs of progress. Like, and I think also I thought about this a little bit around the draft. This is another crack theory of mine. And I thought about it with Mitchell. I feel like the fact that Jrue Holiday broke through and won a championship, I think maybe we will look back as like a very important moment in defense, because he has made like playing one-on-one sort of stick to your man. Like, not only can he do it really well, but he's made it cool. Like, if you listen to all these players talk about it, it was striking to me how many guards in this draft were like, yeah, I studied Jrue Holiday film. I want to be like Jrue Holiday. And like, how many guards would have said that 3 years ago? Like, oh yeah, Jrue Holiday is my model. But
it would have been Steph or Russ, right? Those are the two guys right. It would have been.
And maybe I'm underestimating to the degree to which like players like Jrue Holiday, and I'm just like kind of observing from afar.
Players Jrue Holiday, they love him.
I'm noticing much more of it. Maybe it's just more mainstream now because he just won. But there's something about his style of play that people are trying to replicate. And you have more of these players coming into the league who basically look like defensive backs, and they're just able to kind of keep just moving with people. And I think we're starting to see, a return to like legitimately modern physical man-to-man defense. We're starting to see that.
It's my brand. I mean, that's what I would love to see.
It's Miami Heat basketball, isn't it?
It really is. This team specifically, I feel like they just kind of pulled my questionnaires and built the perfect team for my brand of basketball. Mm-hmm. Even us missing the threes is kind of like, yeah, well, showed me you can overcome adversity and win in the game. You know what I mean? Like, that's my whole C.
Yeah. I mean, I have concerns about whether they can do this for 82 games. I was famously pretty down on Miami because of that. But yeah, if they're still healthy, I mean, you look at all the guys they have so many guys on their team who are like low to the ground pit bull types.
Yeah.
Like, you talk about like, why is Jimmy Butler like able to succeed? It's because he can get so low to the ground all the time. He's literally like, I think of him like he's like kind of, you ever like, did you do Pokemon when you were younger?
Yeah.
So wasn't there like a Pokemon who was like, I just remember always dominating with this one in the playing the games where he would like the digger one, the one that come up through the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Diglett. Yeah. Jimmy Butler is like basketball Diglett underneath people. He's so strong like that. And like, that's why he succeeds. Like he can get so low on defense and then just spring out of that. You can't move him. And then on offense, he's like kind of burrowing like underneath you, and then like you have no choice but to back up with him.
Yeah.
And then he pivots around. That's why it was the guys who he struggles with are like the Giannis's, the Anthony Davis, the guys who are just like, I'm really tall, you don't shoot, I'm just not gonna let you get into me, and I'm just gonna go like stand with my arms up. Like, that's why those guys I think give him a lot of problems. But against like a typical like kind of defender who is about his size but not as strong down here, like, he just physically manhandles him. And that's the key to his success.